Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Since Hamas's October 7th attack on Israel, where Hamas kidnapped, killed, and brutalized more than 1,000 Israeli men, women, and children, the Israeli Defense Force's response has killed at least 22,000 Gazan men, women, and children, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. The conflict has also spilled over into the West Bank. On December 27th, the UN High Commission on Human Rights issued a report outlining human rights violations documented by the OHCHR in the West Bank. The UN report states that between October 7th to December 27th, Israeli security forces conducted mass arrests detaining more than 4,700 Palestinians. Ajit Sungay is the head of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory.
Which has happened in the past, but nothing compared to the numbers we've seen now. It's about 4,700 Palestinians from West Bank who are now in detention, many of them in administrative detention. Reasons unknown. Families do not know about those reasons. And many of them have no criminal reasons or background.
Sungay says more than 490 Palestinians in the West Bank have been killed, the highest number since UN records began in 2005.
We've seen Israeli security forces using tactics and weapons that are basically used in an armed conflict. For instance, airstrikes, use of drones, use of snipers, thousands of troops, etc., etc. Where, in fact, in West Bank, the force that should be used is as if there is a law enforcement legal framework. So those two have led in massive casualties.
Sungay also adds that the UN finds that escalation is taking an even greater toll on West Bank Palestinians due to mobility restrictions that were already in place.
Palestinians are unable to move at this stage between towns, between communities. There are major roadblocks, there are earth mounds, there are flying checkpoints, there are military checkpoints, and so on and so forth, which has massively impacted on the community, on their business, the school, and their day-to-day life, basically. And has impacted a range of what we call as the economic, social, cultural rights of Palestinians.
The UN also says that Israeli settlers have taken advantage of the conflict in the West Bank and accelerated their displacement of Palestinians, including attacking West Bank communities and poisoning and vandalizing olive trees to prevent the harvest. And in its report, the UN issues an urgent call to all nations, quote, especially nations with influence, to do all they can to stop the spread of violence in the West Bank. Well, just this weekend, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in the region. Upon landing in Jordan, he insisted the U.S. continues to do all it can.
As we've said from day one, we have an intense focus on preventing this conflict from spreading. And a big part of the conversations we'll be having over the coming days with all of our allies and partners is looking at the steps that they can take, using the influence and ties that they have, to do just that, to make sure that this conflict doesn't spread.
Well, today we're going to focus extensively on what's happening in the West Bank. And we'll begin with Ibrahim Dal-Alsha. He's the director at the Horizon Center for Political Studies and Media Outreach. It's a think tank in Ramallah, in the West Bank. Later on in the show, we'll hear from Israeli analyst Menachem Klein. But first, Ibrahim Dal-Alsha, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And
I want to
first note that you're actually speaking to us today from Florida. You were able to come to the United States for family purposes. But I wonder if you could first of all describe what happened in regarding those mobility restrictions to Palestinians in the West Bank, and particularly for you, following October 7th.
Yeah, When talking about mobility in the West Bank, I just have to tell you that there are so many eruptions, so many problems in terms of movement, access, and the like. But one of the biggest problems that we have been experiencing in the West Bank following the October 7 attacks is the collective measures and punishment that has been placed on the entire West Bank and its population. And when you actually take that down to personal level, you know, I, as someone who has been allowed to enter into Jerusalem, which is part of the West Bank, except for Israeli illegal annexation of it, and there are Palestinians who actually live in that part. I have my daughters and my granddaughters living there, and I have not really been able to visit them. It was much easier for me to come to Florida than actually going to visit my granddaughters who are like 5 miles away from me. The impact, you know, people speak of social rights, of political rights, of all kinds of, you know, categories that are defined. But I think what is missing from this is the human personal element of huge frustration and anger of being subjected to punishment while you basically have nothing to do with what's happening, not the horrific attacks that were carried out in against Israel on October 7. And not even the ensuing Israeli retaliations against the civilian population in Gaza. So, you know, the experience is just going from bad to worse. Mm. And when we take it to the human personal level of it, it's indescribable. Although, you know, like, you know, reports and documentation of violations are out there, but I think what is missing is the human element mm-hmm. in it, mm-hmm. which is, I think, much more powerful than any ink can write in terms of, you know, how you describe this. Because the way I feel it is very plain and simple. I'm just being punished for being a Palestinian living in my own hometown. And incidentally, I was born in Jerusalem.
Mm. So to be clear, you've had permits to enter Jerusalem for a couple of decades. Even though it was challenging, you were successfully able to go in and out of Jerusalem. And as of October 7th, that is no longer possible for you or any Palestinian.
Correct.
Has that ever happened before?
The truth is no, because before you would actually, and even there, you know, there's a, as you said, like there's a little bit of suffering, and basically eventually you get it. So you're subjected to a security check, screening, you do not pose a threat, and then you're basically given a permit and allowed. But this time around, it doesn't really matter who you are and what you are and what's your security background. There is a blanket closure. Which actually prevents people from going to Jerusalem. And as the report mentioned, it's not only about entering Jerusalem, it's also about moving in the West Bank. So, you know, like the collective punishment here is being applied in a blanket way without actually, you know, making any differences, whether individual, it doesn't really matter. Whether you had it before or not, it's just a blanket measure that is being applied on all.
Mm. How else has day-to-day life changed in the West Bank? I mean, what kind of actions are people seeing from the Israeli security forces? We'll talk about settlers in a moment, but what do you think is important to understand for how day-to-day life has changed in the West Bank?
You know, to be honest with you, I think that the first of all, the situation in the West Bank before October 7 was not easy and was not calm either. So the, you know, it has worsened indeed, but it didn't really come out of a total calm into like a tension reality. So you know, we had something like 500 people killed in the West Bank during confrontations, during Israeli army incursions into Palestinian towns. True that 320 or more of those were actually killed after October 7, mm-hmm. But we still had incidents happening. Now, you know, I think the major difference has been the erection of flying checkpoints and roadblocks across the Bank people from moving, you know, moving from one town into the other within the West Bank. And that's not about crossing into Israel or Jerusalem. This is basically, you know, moving from one town to the other, from Nablus to Ramallah, from Ramallah to Jenin to Hebron, you know, the Palestinian communities and population centers that we have in the West Bank. And, you know, there was no real sort of like justification or reason given that meant to minimize friction between Israelis and Palestinians in the West Bank, meaning Israeli settlers who live in the West Bank. And again, you know, when you look at this situation as a Palestinian, you actually feel that even when it comes to preventing worse evil, you know, there are no restrictions whatsoever on Israeli settlers. These have to be on Palestinian population, regardless of their motives and regardless whether Palestinians are attacking settlers or not. In fact, you know, there are the records are and statistically is proven that settlers are the ones who are basically attacking Palestinians, not the other way around. But still, you know, like the Palestinians who are being subjected to this element. I think, you know, in addition to arrests, mass arrests that have been taking place since October 7, and many of those, we're talking about thousands of cases, 2,500 are still kept in custody since October 7. And, you know, about 1,400 of those have been placed under administrative, essentially means that there are no charges and there is no prosecution. This is just a precautionary kind of, you know, preemptive type of
detention. Yeah.
Yes, on suspicion that you may or may not have been involved in any, you know, sort of like anti-Israeli activities in those areas. Mm.
Well, Ibrahim Dal Alsha, stand by for just a moment. We're heading towards our first break here. When we come back, I'm going to want to talk with you about what you think. I mean, you've been a political analyst in the West Bank for quite some time, and what you think the intention here is of the Israeli government, given that its statement was to eradicate Hamas in Gaza. So today we're talking about the reality of life on the ground in the West Bank. We'll hear from Israeli analyst Menachem Klein a little later in the show. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken? A podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Ibrahim Dal Alsha joins us today. He's the director of the Horizon Center for Political Studies and Media Outreach. It's a think tank in Ramallah in the West Bank. And we're talking about the situation in the West Bank right now. And Ibrahim, we discussed the mass arrests that have been taking place, as documented also by the UN High Commission for Human Rights. We've talked about the increase in the number of killings of Palestinians in the West Bank. But I also want to know what those movement restrictions, the domino effect it's having on the West Bank as a whole, because if people can't move around or get into Jerusalem, as you were talking about before, that means they can't get to work either. Is there a broader impact across the West Bank?
Yes, in fact, when we talk about the broader impact, especially in terms of employment, I mean, it's double effect. One is that we have more than roughly 200,000 Palestinian workers who had permits to work inside Israel, who have been denied work since October 7th. This actually represents about 33% of the income that actually comes into the West Bank. And that is coupled with an Israeli government measure against the Palestinian Authority, which hires actually 190,000 people, by withholding tax revenues that Israel collects on behalf of the Palestinians, which actually resulted in a situation where the two major pipes of income into the West Bank, the public sector employees who basically are unpaid or paid 50% of their salaries, and then, you know, like the 200,000 or so Palestinian workers working in Israel with no income. And you can imagine that those are like the two main pipes of income into the West Bank have been cut since October 7th. So in terms of the economic hardships, the purchasing power of people, you know, the flow of cash in the local market has actually been hit very hard in the past 3 months. You know, this is coupled with, you know, the movement restrictions and all of that. I mean, you know, like it's essentially a situation where it's a total standstill of an entire community waiting for, you know, the situation to unfold in Gaza, because the impression is that these measures in the West Bank have been applied because of the situation in Gaza.
Mm. Now, so, yeah. Well, as you know, the December 27th report from the UN issued strong recommendations to the government of Israel, saying that the UN wants the government of Israel to urgently take steps, urgently, it says, to stop the killing and unlawful detention of Palestinians in the West Bank, end the use of military weapons and operations there, and issue clear and unambiguous orders to all Israeli security forces regarding the effective protection of the Palestinian population and stop incidents of settler violence there. Now, presuming that little of these things will happen, I mean, I don't know if the Israeli government has issued any statement about whether or not it will comply with the UN, but what may happen in the West Bank, Ibrahim, if these actions are not taken?
I want to tell you that I follow Israeli media very closely, and I don't really think that the Israeli government gives any serious regard to UN or its recommendations. It has not happened before, and I actually would be pleasantly surprised if it does happen this time or any other time in the future. But, you know, I want to tell you that there are like reliable reports out there in the Israeli media that talks about Israeli security establishment recommendations to the Israeli government on specific aspects and measures that are being applied in the West Bank, mainly, you know, when it comes to employment, when it comes to Palestinian workers not being able to come to work in Israel, and the impact that this has on Israeli economy and on the West Bank, you know, social, economic, and security situation in terms of the negative impact that it will have. In fact, even warning that this could actually worsen the situation to an eruption of violence. So, you know, I think we have a very, you know, serious situation and a problem there. And I don't, you know, actually reveal a secret by saying that on the current Israeli government and cabinet, we have, or you know, there are Israeli extremists, far right ministers whose intentions, as declared, are not really to come to terms with the you know, security, tranquility, stability in the West Bank. In fact, it's all about far right nationalist agenda in terms of you know, depopulating the West Bank and and the Gaza Strip. Mm. So here we're talking about an ideology-driven policy rather than a policy that is driven on factors of security, stability, and coexistence. And the question that you asked before, and I'm sorry to say it, but I have actually spent 30 years of my professional life working and advocating on, issues that related to coexistence, finding a peaceful resolution, the so-called two-state solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I increasingly feel that not only that I and fellow, and like-minded people have been disappointed, but I think basically that we are losing it to extremists on both sides who want to control the agenda into an endless conflict. So the short answer to your question is that there will be an eruption, and that eruption of violence is becoming the main feature of the Israeli-Palestinian reality. Once every 15 to 20 years, with new generations coming in, whether Palestinians or Israelis, the only course of action, the reality that they face, is a major eruption, after which they get tired, they sort of like rest a bit, and then it comes back again with ups and downs. I mean, it doesn't really take a genius. If you follow this from 1967 all the way until today, it's every 15 years you have a major eruption, because there is no political solution to the conflict that is being embraced by neither side. Mm. And I'm not going to advocate for a political solution now. I'm just saying that so long as there is no political solution to anything other than, repeated eruptions of violence. Yeah. And the sad reality is each time it's even much worse than what happened before.
Right. Well, Ibrahim, I'd like you to just stand by for a moment, because I want to bring in Menachem Klein into the conversation. He's professor emeritus at the Bar-Ilan University in Israel, and he's with us from Jerusalem. Professor Klein, welcome to you.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
So first of all, you heard what Ibrahim Dalalsha has been saying. Let's focus on the possibility of a much larger eruption of violence in the West Bank. Do you think the continued operations of Israeli security forces there could not just lead to this eruption in the West Bank, but spill over into the region more broadly, such as Jordan next door?
It may spill over if there are extreme right wing elements in our government will have a chance to implement their forced immigration transfer plan to push maximum West Bank Palestinians to Jordan. This is their scenario. This is their preferred solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Unlike Netanyahu and company, mainstream Israeli cabinet ministers that want to continue conflict management, They want to solve it by immigration, forced immigration, the conflict. Neither the extremists nor the mainstream call to go back to talks on solving the conflict through peaceful means. Go back to two-state solutions or one state equally to everybody, for every person, one vote, or two collectives in one state, a federal state. Never mind, they don't want it. They want Jewish supremacy. And Jewish supremacy today is a kind of apartheid style in the West Bank. Israel uses apartheid methods in the West Bank, not inside Israel, according to my analysis, neither in Gaza Strip before October 7, but in the West Bank, yes. Actually, what we have in the West Bank, and here this is a fundamental question that clarifies the situation. Is there a border between West Bank and Israel? And if there is a border, to whom, to which collective this border is meaningful? Now, if there is a border, it is not a border for the Israelis. Israeli Jews expand into the West Bank. If there is a border, or many borders, actually, and here I agree with my colleague on the flying, flying roadblocks and flying borders, these borders are relevant only for the Palestinians. And we have to bear in mind this situation.
So, Professor Klein, I mean, what you're talking about here is the far right of wing of the Israeli government, just to restate what you were saying, is actually wishes for far more than an end to the current conflict. An end to, they're wishing for an expulsion of Palestinians from the West Bank. Now, according to what you're saying, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu often, not always, but often continues to insist that the goal of the Israeli government right now is an eradication of Hamas. Now, with the continued actions of Israeli security forces in West Bank as they are, does that not undermine not just the West Bank, the Palestinian people living there, but the Palestinian Authority as well, who would be needed for any resolution to the current conflict? Or does the... does the Israeli war cabinet not care?
Netanyahu and the mainstream in the cabinet, they don't want the Palestinian Authority to enter Gaza Strip. They are afraid that once the Gaza Strip, or the political force managing Gaza Strip and the one managing the West Bank, unite under one regime, this is the first step towards a Palestinian state. All cabinet ministers, present cabinet ministers in Israel, they rule out any option of having a Palestinian state, and they want and they work since 2007 to divide West Bank and Gaza Strip politically, and they maintain the rivalry between Hamas and Fatah in the West Bank. So they don't want them to unite. They don't want Mahmoud Abbas regime to enter into the Gaza Strip. The key question is whether the United States, that is interested to see Ramallah managing Gaza, whether this administration is ready to put heavy pressure on the Israeli government. I doubt about that.
So I want to come back to that point in a moment. And Ibrahim, I'll return to you here. But Professor Klein, who has control of the Israeli war cabinet right now?
The majority is Netanyahu and the mini war cabinet, which is formed up with ex-generals party. They are mainstream right-wing persons. So the anti-permanent agreement solution, they rule the cabinet. They want a conflict management. They don't want conflict resolution. They don't want even a Palestinian state, to see a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza. They mistrust the Abbas regime. They mistrust Fatah. And they are unwilling to open negotiations on final status agreement.
Yeah. Ibrahim Dal-Alsha, I appreciate your patience here. I'm sure you have many thoughts about what Professor Klein is saying. Go ahead.
Yeah, I do. And I think, frankly, the reality is that two decades before October 7, we had, the Second Intifada at the time, which was actually followed by resumption of security coordination between Israeli security forces and Palestinian authority security forces. since 2005, when President Abbas was elected as the president of the Palestinian Authority, we had three U.S. administrations under Bush and twice under President Obama trying to move forward with a political solution to the conflict, and the three attempts failed. Now, regardless who's to blame for the failure, at the end of the day, it failed, and we entered into a new major eruption. And my my thinking, and I'm actually sorry to say that, but I think, you know, I differentiate between what I think will happen and what should happen. Mm. I think what should happen is essentially a process, even if it's a lengthy process. No one needs to trust anyone. I mean, the Israeli logic of basically wanting to have Palestinians as loyal citizens of the state of Israel without having Israeli passports and nationality and rights is not going to happen. And, you know, separation between Palestinians and Israelis is a path that could be taken, even if it goes gradual. So instead of actually spending, you know, the next 20 years deepening the occupation and building more settlements and increasing Israeli settlers and boosting them in the West Bank territory, you could actually do otherwise, which is like deoccupying certain parts of the West Bank and let Palestinians basically have an entity of their own on a gradual basis. That's what should happen. What will not it's not going to happen. I think that the Israeli mainstream now is actually mobilized by force to actually hit Hamas and causing collateral damage of 70% of Palestinian victims that were killed in Gaza are civilians documented to be women and children.
Ibrahim Dal Alsha, I'm so sorry. I will let you complete your thought in just a moment, but we just have to take this very quick break. So we'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're discussing the situation currently on the ground in the West Bank. And Menachem Klein joins us. He's professor emeritus at the Bar-Ilan University in Israel. And Ibrahim Dal Alsha is with us as well. He's director of the Horizon Center for Political Studies and Media Outreach in Ramallah in the West Bank. And I apologize for having had to interrupt you a little earlier, Ibrahim. We just had to take that break. Please go ahead and continue your thought on what you think will happen in the West Bank versus what you think should happen.
Yes, I think, frankly, the situation is as such that you have far-right ideology, as my colleague just explained, on the Israeli side. And I have to tell you that, you know, we had a mainstream camp on the Palestinian side advocating for a two-state solution, coexistence and peace. And my worry is that after October 7 and the ensuing war, I think that the extremists on our side, too, have the high ground. And, you know, if there are Israeli ministers who are thinking of expelling Palestinians into Jordan and elsewhere, we are witnessing a period of radicalization on the Palestinian side where people are saying, you know, we have been advocating for attacking, we actually need to go back where we come from, because, you know, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict did not really start in 1967. It started in 1948. So there are even more voices now who are basically saying Haifa, Yaffa, and incidentally, 70% of Palestinians are refugees who have been expelled from those areas before 1967. And therefore, the radicalization is becoming, and the extremism is actually taking over. So, you know, whether they will be able to materialize that or not, it doesn't really matter. Israel is like a strong country, powerful, they've got military, so it won't really happen that way. But it actually means that the conflict will continue, and the worst is yet to come.
Yeah. Well, Professor Klein, let me ask you, it's quite something to hear Ibrahim Dal-Alshah say, him having been a long-term supporter of a two-state solution, and at least at this moment, feeling far less hope that that might ever come to pass. Now, we also know that Israel's far right has basically never wanted a two-state solution. I mean, in a sense, are we at a point now where virtually all hope is lost for that path towards peace in the region?
Many people lost hope. Also in Israel. But among my colleagues, to the supporters and activists for two-state solution, I started hearing new voices that we made mistakes in our proposals during Oslo time. Our concept were wrong. We should rethink and go back in much different proposal, or go back to negotiate and offer a very different concept of a two-state solution, be it confederation, be it let's say it in so many words, treat differently with the 1948 refugee issues and the Palestinian attachment to Jaffa and Haifa, the right to return to their places, seeing 48 areas or the sovereign Israel areas as part of Palestinian history. All these are now open to reconsideration among Israeli leftists within the peace camp. The de facto one regime that we have all over the area, from Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, this creates new thinking, even inside the Israeli left and what remained from in the peace camp, for the remainder of the peace camp. So there are new thinking there. And hopefully, once the international community resume its interest in final status agreement, there are new thoughts that we can build on. But I fully agree with my colleague. It's at the moment there is a process of radicalization. Jewish supremacy is very popular in the Israeli public, the not only the party, the public mind is built around Jewish supremacy, and a movement that Kahana gang movement, racist movement that was once small minority, now is inside the mainstream, not only the cabinet, but yes, in public opinion.
I've been reading in the Israeli press reporting that, for example, far-right Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir is getting more popular in the Israeli mainstream. And there's even some concern that if an election were to be held, maybe he could come close or even topple Benjamin Netanyahu. Now, Ibrahim Dal-Alshah, just want to take one moment. We've been focusing on Israel and the Israeli government and military for obvious reasons. But I want to hear a little bit more from you about something that you mentioned in an interview in The New Yorker magazine. You were asked about regarding Hamas, Palestinian support for Hamas may be increasing now due to the destruction that has been going on in Gaza. And they also asked you if there's any feeling that Hamas's actions have caused the increased hardships for Palestinians, particularly in the West Bank.
I just have one comment to make on the radicalization organization opinions, both in Israel and among the Palestinians. You know, extremism taken over, I think, by far, you know, since October 7, both societies are being mobilized into fight them until the very last man standing kind of situation. And this is, you know, some senior people, including the Israeli prime minister, who came on public in a public statement, say, you know, recalling from the Bible, the Jews' fight against Amalek, which incidentally, you know, brings in the religious element and aspect of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, to which there is no two-state solution, and in my opinion, there is no solution. That is where, you know, if you recall Amalek, you know, on the other side, there are those who actually believe that Judgment Day will not come until all Jews are killed. So, you know, if we're talking about this kind of mainstream and this kind of environment, then we're really doomed. And this is, I think, frankly, that this is a call, a last call, maybe, for all people who believe in coexistence, in human life as a value and in dignity and right and justice in the sense of, you know, reaching out to a secure and stable environment for both people, need to basically fight this out. Now, you know, my colleague is talking about some thinking that would actually better, you know, offers and proposals to, you know, come up with a political solution. My thinking is that we need to start at one point. And this start, you know, it can be a gradual process. It doesn't have to be instant, immediate creation of a Palestinian state, but creating a different reality. So every day we wake up to a new positive reality with one step further towards a solution rather than being stuck in religious faith, ill-interpreted faith interpretations, and basically taking both Palestinians and Israelis to hell's reality. The immediate answer to your question is, I think, you know, we have a situation that does not really take us closer into, you know, security, calm, or tranquility in the West Bank. We're actually, you know, moving towards more pressure and more force that is being applied against the civilian population. Hamas's popularity, I think, is incidental as a response to the emotional frustration of the footage that comes out of Gaza. It's not, yes, you know, this is not an ideological support for Hamas. It's actually an expression of venting and sentiments, again, of frustration and anger for what's happening, and the sense of being victimized and punished for without having been, you know, necessarily part of what has happened.
Let me ask you, when I hear you say that possibly something more fundamental than a political solution is urgently needed right now, is that why you told The New Yorker, I'm just reading the quote here, "We are in a very bad moment of our conflict, to the point that I think the problem now is not only about making peace after this war, we are even below the level of accepting each other's right to exist."
I do believe that firmly, yes, because, you know, again, as I told you, I watch almost extensively Israeli media. And I, you know, one of the things that I actually hear is that people mainstream justify what happens in Gaza in terms of the excessive number of people that have been killed, civilians that have been killed, by actually saying, oh, it doesn't really matter, they are Hamas supporters. I mean, there is a level, the scary level of mainstream mobilization against each other, and you know, and I'm not acquitting, you know, on the Palestinian side, it's the same thing. Like, you know, the idea is that we need to fight, and we need to fight until end of days, is actually growing momentum. And the problem is that it's growing momentum across the younger generation. And by the way, the Palestinian people are, you know, 70% of Palestinians are below the age of 40. It's a very young, you know, generation. So those people have no concept of previous attempts to actually create peace. They just were born into a reality of occupation, yeah. and they continue to experience it. And as such, all of the sentiments are really being built that way. And there are no leaderships on neither side to actually steer them away from it by creating an alternative reality that works. Mm. That is, I think, you know, what is missing. I don't expect the Palestinian people one day to wake up and basically say, oh, we just want peace, we give up, we can't really fight anymore. That's not going to happen. And the thing is, the same thing on the Israeli side. They will continue to, I think, you know, now, especially after the October 7 attacks and the experience, the trauma that the Israeli society has experienced under that, they will continue to think that, you know, only force and more force is what is going to protect us. And it's a doomed, you know, fate for both sides.
Right. Well, you know, I just going back for a moment to the movement restrictions that have been further strengthened on Palestinians in the West Bank. I want to note that it's also possible that I think the IDF has said that that part of their intention with that is to restrict the movement of anyone associated with Hamas in the West Bank and to find them. So that is another just a point of view and stated intention from Israeli security forces. But in the last few minutes, and we only have a few minutes left, I want to actually just take a minute to hear quickly from both of you your assessment on the United States and its use and its influence in this situation right now. I mean, Professor Klein, just quickly, has the U.S. been, you know, effective at all? And if so, if not, what more should it do?
I try to the basic question that I ask myself is how we get out from where we are and where we want to go. What I am afraid that these questions are not seriously dealt with in the American administration. They want only the immediate and the very, very practical to be implemented, and that's it. They don't look behind the next week. Oh, sorry. And what we need is a far-sight perspective, an administration that have a vision, and then tell the sides, this is our vision, and we will work to implement it with you. We will work closely with you, and we will do everything to get there. This is not done by Biden administration, and as any other American administration, the Biden administration is also pro-Israeli. It's too close to Israel, too biased by Israeli interest, and is not using the tough love that a mediator should use in order to reach an agreement.
Mm. Well, Ibrahim Dal Alsha, we have about 30 seconds remaining. You've worked closely with the U.S. government, very closely with the U.S. government in the past. I know you want the U.S. to exercise more real leverage in this situation, but what leverage is that?
I think, frankly, yes, I did work with the U.S. administration for 20 years of my lifetime. And I think that, frankly, the main change needs to come from within the Palestinians and Israelis. So advocates of coexistence and, you know, whatever political solution can we agree on, I think that the U.S. will actually come and support and make happen. I think the leverage that I actually was... you know, referring to is to stop the current, war in Gaza and to get us back on a track where we can go back to our senses, both as Palestinians and Israelis. I don't think that the U.S. can actually impose a solution. I think it can help us reach a solution. But the main job needs to be done by both societies, the Israelis and the Palestinians.
Well, Ibrahim Dal Alsha is the director of the Horizon Center for Political Studies and Media Outreach. That's in Ramallah in the West Bank. And Menachem Klein is professor emeritus at the Bar-Ilan University in Israel. He's in Jerusalem. Gentlemen, I thank you both. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.